And I'll call our next case, which is case number 76117 in the matter of the Honorable Rena Hughes, 8th Judicial District Court, Family Division, Department J. We'll let everybody take a few minutes to get set up for... Okay, if everybody's ready, we'll go ahead and see if we have Mr. Marks and Ms. Young representing Judge Hughes. We have Mr. Bradley representing the Commission on Judicial Discipline. Mr. Dyla, the Executive Director of the Commission for Judicial Discipline, is present as well. Mr. Marks, would you like to reserve any time? You may do so.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Nevada Supreme Court, my name is Daniel Marks, and I'm here with Nicole Young, representing the Honorable Family Court Judge Rena Hughes. The issue presented in this appeal is whether the Nevada Commission on Judicial Discipline can essentially discipline a judge for really what are legal errors occurring in the heat of a hotly contested family court custody case, obviously down in family court. Commission Rule 8 specifically prohibits discipline for errors of law, including incomplete findings of fact. The discipline here is for a legal error, and we think the Commission exceeded its jurisdiction by disciplining Judge Hughes. The timing of this complaint was also troubling because the party made no effort by way of writ or appeal to contest Judge Hughes's order. She essentially stipulated to the custodial change by letting it go for some 6 months, but went to judicial discipline as a way of trying to vindicate her appellate rights. And if you look at the decision of judicial discipline, it's a 13-page written decision which essentially encroaches on your power as the Supreme Court. It deals with 14th Amendment, which we know books, treatises, and were written on. It deals with best interest, which you have a lot of cases on. And they essentially put their own spin on what is the best interest of the child standard that you've interpreted from the legislature. What the commission did is it took 15 minutes out of a 15-month custody case. We think every case in law, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. But family court's unique because you could be in front of a family court judge on the same or similar issues multiple times. In this case, the dad was in front of the predecessor judge and then Judge Hughes for some 8 or 9 hearings over a 15-month period. He had in place court orders for custody and visitation. He had joint legal custody, yet he couldn't see his child. Judge Hughes went to 2 other family court judges, the presiding judge, Judge Hoskins, talked to Judge Steele, and talked to Judge Elliott, all 3 of which have enormous experience. She tried counseling of the mom. She tried Donna's house, which is a safe space, all to really try to get the mom comfortable that the dad could see the child under those conditions. When all else failed, she had no choice. She was dead. Courts obviously don't have private police. They can issue a writ of arrest and literally have Metro go out and pick up the child, which is something judges don't want to do and is rarely used, or there could be a pickup order in court. Essentially what Judge Hughes did was transfer and have a pickup order in court for a dad who had not seen his child in 15 months, who had missed over 100 days of visitation. If anything, in the totality of these circumstances, Judge Hughes actually showed a lot of judicial restraint.
Didn't she actually change custody, even if it was a temporary custody order at that hearing, which is not just a pickup for visitation?
Correct, but here's the situation. Judges, as we speak, are making temporary orders. Family court is different than a normal civil case. Every day, as we speak now, they could be making temporary orders on the motion calendar.
Okay.
It's not unheard of.
Are they required to make findings when they do so?
When you change custody, don't you follow your best interests and make findings?
Sure. But what happened, the case is cited by the commission, and the thrust of the proceedings in front of the commission treated this as a permanent order. They cited Sims, Lewis, and Gordon v. Geiger.
Are you saying there's a difference in the findings requirement if it's temporary or permanent?
Sure, because when you file a case in a typical divorce, and you file a complaint, and you file a motion for fees and allowances, temporary custody, the amount of findings that have been traditionally over the length of years for a temporary custody order is never the same as after a full-blown evidentiary hearing and trial. And the commission failed to understand that.
Doesn't there have to have been a hearing to change custody even temporarily?
Sure.
But I thought your client's position is this wasn't a hearing.
She called it a pickup order. I think anything in a courthouse, in a courtroom, is a hearing, as I define it. But I know other lawyers dispute that. I know other judges dispute it. In family court, unfortunately, you have what could be an evidentiary hearing or trial, which we think of as witnesses sworn, evidence taken, the rules of evidence apply.
I'm sure not every hearing is an evidentiary hearing.
Correct. So on the motion calendar, rules of evidence often don't apply. That's criticized a lot where attorneys get up and say, he abused the kid, he didn't see the kid, he did this, he did that. And that's been the standard of practice as long as I've been practicing, and it goes on today. The issue is, can judges make those temporary orders that they've been allowed to do? There were findings.
Does she need to have a hearing to do so?
Here's the difference. There had been 9 hearings giving the dad custody. He had legal custody. This isn't a stranger. He was not getting enforcement. Historically, in family court, there have been real problems of enforcement. Should there be another hearing, please, 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 mom, comply? Is that then required to have another hearing? The commission was well-meaning here, but they did not understand.
Excuse me, but didn't Judge Ellett, didn't she act on just a notice from Donna's house, which is an indirect contempt, so to speak, that you would need a hearing to find out what the facts were of some notice that she received from Donna's house? It's just like in any other court, whether it's civil or criminal, and you get a notice of something that happens outside the courtroom, you have a hearing on what happened to find out what the facts are and not just act on a piece of paper.
What happened was she knew that Dad, this was the culmination of 8 or 9 failures of a dad to see his child. He has 14th Amendment rights, as much as the mom.
But if you're going to hold somebody in contempt, an indirect contempt, based on a letter from Donna's house, you have to have a hearing. Do you not? An actual hearing where you actually have both parties present and present evidence that what they're saying occurred in the letter occurred.
I agree with you, and she didn't hold her in contempt. Some of the language and some of the documentation.
I would say all of it.
Excuse me?
All the documentation, all the minutes, all the hearings, all the pleadings said contempt.
But it also said in the written order that a hearing for contempt will be held later. She never held the woman in contempt for this violation.
And actually her testimony goes back and forth. I mean, I think the orders are ambiguous in that it says it's a contempt. I'm finding you in contempt, but we're going to have a hearing on an order to show cause why we shouldn't find you in contempt. So the orders seem internally inconsistent. And what's worrisome to me is if she had written instead, it appears to me you have violated my orders that you and Dad have joint physical custody, and therefore I'm going to issue an order to show cause why you should not be held in contempt, and we're going to have a hearing 30 days hence on that issue, we wouldn't be here.
Correct.
Is that fair?
That's fair. She did the right thing. She didn't say it correctly. I've had other judges say you're in contempt, and I think they mean it more in a lay sense.
Then you're violating the order.
Exactly.
Doesn't that go to confidence of the judge, though, to not know how to hold, to have a hearing in order to then hold somebody in contempt? To just say it the way she said it almost looks about competence.
Justice Silver, she did set the evidentiary hearing for contempt, held the hearing, and found the mom not in contempt. So she did the right thing.
Because it turned out the order had never been filed.
And the woman got an attorney, and obviously with an attorney and arguing it, you could argue that I'm not held in contempt. This is a person who sort of created the situation on her own. She had an attorney. The orders were coming down. Dad has to see the child. She either didn't cooperate or fired her attorney who withdrew. After her attorney withdrew, her conduct almost was trying to bait the judge, hey, almost like King Solomon, cut the baby down the middle. She flagrantly violated the court orders and refused. And the issue...
Right, so that there may well have been ultimately a contempt sanction appropriate, but that's not the issue. The question is, did she properly do so, and did she change custody of the child as some sort of a punishment of the mom?
Okay, but there's two points here. She didn't hold the woman in contempt for violating the court orders. The hearing on the contempt, once the woman got an attorney, it was a full-blown evidentiary hearing, the contempt was denied. The dad was owed by 100 days of time. You don't have to hold a hearing to enforce an already valid court order. The mom wasn't contending the court order before was invalid. The mom was just saying, I'm not following it. You don't understand. For instance, she refused to go to counseling or pay the counselor.
Did the court change the custody status or just grant visitation?
I know it's hard to say for a judge, it's semantics, but the dad was owed probably 100 days.
Right.
Giving the dad the child, if the woman had showed up without the child in court and there was a hearing and she was held in contempt where you can only fine or go to jail, that wouldn't get the dad the child. So you're in this nightmare custody case where the dad wants the child, he doesn't want to pay a lawyer to hold the mom in contempt to get a fine, he just wants the child. Judge Hughes did the right thing in getting Dad the child. She set a full-blown evidentiary hearing before changing custody permanently. The issue is one, to some extent, of the semantics. But this court has never held you can't make temporary orders without a full evidentiary hearing. And the cases cited by the commission...
Mr. Marks, we have said that before making those custody changes, there must be an evaluation of the best interests of the child.
On a permanent...
And I don't see where in the order that was done.
She used the words best interest. The order could have been better, obviously, and clearer, but she did recognize it. And my concern is, this is an enforcement. If you rule that every time a judge takes strong enforcement, and this happens a lot with kids, where someone will almost be saying, yeah, hold me in contempt, I'll go to jail, but you're still not going to see the child, the issue was getting the other party who had every right that this woman has. He was a joint legal custodian. He had not seen his kids in 15 months, and there was no basis to deny that. Why shouldn't he be able to get the child? Obviously, the documentation could have been better, but do you want the Nevada Judicial Commission to take over your job? This could have been appealed or written. You could set forth what findings are needed. Do we need another intermediate appellate court? They went way beyond the bounds, and this will have a chilling effect of enforcement.
Well, could you return back to the point Justice Kadish made a moment ago, though? It appears, you say the orders could have been better.
But it seems at the heart of all of this that there was a transfer of custody without any compliance with the best interest requirements and evaluation. And that temporary custody was accomplished through a pickup order. Now, isn't that true?
Except that it's true to a sense. But when you have joint legal custody, essentially you have 100% of rights to your children, right? So there wasn't essentially a change. The parties had legal custody. The dad wasn't getting to see the kid at all.
Well, I'd like to correct you. Just because you have joint legal custody doesn't mean you have joint physical custody.
Correct.
But they had joint physical at the time.
Mom had primary physical. But this was essentially, dad's going to get the child.
Let me just ask this. I know you would argue that, or appear to agree that the language of the order is unclear. But when the litigants left that day, when that hearing ended, if it was a hearing, the understanding was dad had temporary custody.
Correct.
Legal and physical.
Correct.
Isn't that correct?
Correct, but this is the reason. Mom had pulled the kid out of school.
I understand.
You have to understand the reasoning. In real life down there, if you don't have legal custody, you can't sign up your child for school. If they had left it as joint, potentially mom could have said, I want the kid out of school. Dad could say, I want the kid in school. This is a woman who pulled the kid out of the public school, was allegedly doing homeschooling, which violated the Clark County regs. The dad was trying...
Mr. Marks, I'm empathetic to the challenges the family court judges face when parents are unable to agree about the handling of their children, the custody of the children, or the exchange of the children. And I think it is very troublesome that this task falls to the family court judge. But here, the question is whether or not the judge followed the law and was consistent with the canon requirements to accomplish those objectives. What's troubling to me is even though there are numerous pragmatic issues, as you point out, you can't set those aside, can you? And justify orders or decisions that don't take into account mandated requirements.
You have to look at the unintended consequences of all of our actions. If you sanction Judge Hughes for this, you will send a message that enforcement goes out the window because there's no enforcement of custody absent Metro. And then you're saying the only thing you can do is a writ of arrest. Contempt doesn't solve it. There's plenty of times you just want to see your child. You don't want to send the other person to jail.
I don't hear anyone saying she can't order a change of custody if she follows the right procedure or that she can't find someone in contempt if she follows the right procedure. That's really the question.
Temporarily, you can have a hearing, a summary-type hearing, and then hold an evidentiary hearing.
Is that
later,
what this was?
Yes. And the mom stipulated effectively to that custody. You also have appellate courts. You reverse all the time for incomplete findings or more adequate findings. None of the judges in the Gordon case, the Sims case, or the Lewis case were sanctioned or disciplined at all. And you found violations, major violations. Judge Hughes did the right thing. The documentation could have been better. I don't think you want to add a layer in this kind of issue of judicial discipline, to have a layer of a pseudo-appellate court taking your place. If someone thinks the orders are wrong, appeal, writ, rehearing.
You think that these orders would have withstood a writ? These orders, you think, would have withstood a writ?
No, I'm
for
saying...
For best interest,
no.
Even if she would have writ it?
No, I'm saying if someone... People are unhappy with district court decisions, family court decisions every day, sometimes both litigants. That's why there's a court of appeals. That's why there's a Supreme Court. Don't delegate this responsibility, judicial discipline. They're not judges. There's one judge out of six people. They're lay people. Sometimes these family court cases look ugly, but it's the only solution. Don't put judicial discipline in the middle. The decision is strictly a legal decision. And the canons say if someone, she was attempting to do the right thing to get time for dad, she may have not had complete clear orders. What she did was not wrong in accordance with the law on a temporary basis. Don't let judicial discipline get between the district court and this court and essentially be a pseudo court of appeals. That's what they did when you read their opinion.
Okay, Mr. Marks, thank you so much. We had a lot of questions for you. 3 minutes in rebuttal.
I appreciate
3 minutes of Mr. Bradley's time.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Thomas Bradley. I have the privilege of representing the Nevada Commission on Judicial Discipline. The primary issue in this case is there clear and convincing evidence to support the commission's decision to find her in violation of count one. Count one was solely with regard to whether or not Ms. Silva's rights were deprived when she was held in contempt. It didn't have to do with whether or not there was a custodial hearing. Count one was she held in contempt without notice and without a hearing, and was she improperly sanctioned for that? And the sanction, namely, was to change custody.
Mr. Bradley,
as a sword.
Here's a problem that I'm having. Seasoned attorneys and seasoned judges get contempt wrong all the time. Seasoned family court district judges that I have great respect for fail to make findings. How can I distinguish this case of a relatively new judge who seeks counsel from more experienced judges who arguably gets it wrong? And if this were in front of me in that other context, I'd probably reverse. Or I'd say, hey, you should have done this, you should have done that. How do I distinguish this case of legal error from every other case of legal error that I have sitting in my chambers right now?
Well, under Rule 8, a single egregious error is sufficient. And if the error is an abuse of authority or a denial of a fundamental right, and I would say holding somebody in contempt without any notice, without an opportunity to be heard, without an opportunity to cross-examine people that are saying that you violated visitation orders, and summarily changing custody, which this court said you can't do, that's what changes this case from other legal error cases in your chambers. And for the respondent to say she was trying to do the right thing is to give notice, hold a hearing on contempt, give notice, hold a hearing on making a temporary change in custody. That is not complicated. That is not something that an experienced judge can say, I just didn't know. I think the Goldman case said judges have a duty to understand and follow the law of contempt. Other courts from California believe the canon decision said.
But I want to distinguish understanding and not understanding. For willful misconduct, what I would suggest to you is, I know what the law of contempt is, and I don't care. Like, what I want to do is more important than that law. That's willfully, I know what it is, and I don't care. If you think you know what it is and you're getting it wrong, how does that rise to the level of willful misconduct such, not that it shouldn't be reversed, but such that it would be disciplined under those canons?
I don't think it's complicated for Judge Hughes to know that before you hold somebody in contempt, you have to give them notice and a meaningful opportunity to respond. You can't just say, I find him in contempt.
But this record's a mess. She says contempt, but then you get OSCs. Then you eventually, there's some question of whether the woman was ever held in contempt, even though there were custody orders or changes in custody.
So I agree that her orders were a mess. And Justice Pickering said there was some ambiguity. However, I would cite you to the record on appeal, page 371 to 372. I specifically asked her on cross-examination, after you got this report from Donna's house, did you then hold Ms. Silva in contempt on June 8th? Answer, yes. She admitted under oath she found her in contempt. I don't care about anyone.
But she also says, I mean, in fairness to her, she says she was making a prima facie determination that what she had in front of her supported the issuance of an order to show cause why she should not be held in contempt. And consistent with that is the action of setting this for a contempt hearing. The hearing follows, and as far as I can determine, and I agree, the record's a mess, but the hearing follows, and the woman is not held in contempt, and no sanctions are levied against her. I understand that you argue that the change in custody is itself the sanction, and that that sanction is impermissible under Lewis and the cases that preceded it. But I go back and I read Lewis and Dagger and Sims, and from the beginning, they recognize the one exception that our statutes say both parents should have parental relationships with their child, and that where one parent is violating that, there may be custodial orders entered. Footnote 3 in Dagger, and then Sins cites footnote 3 in Dagger. And Lewis, which came down after the May order in this case, again cites Sims, and all of them recognize that where one parent is withholding court-ordered visitation from the other and violating the law in that regard, the judge is not powerless to act. Contempt is not off the table at that point.
My response is, we never heard the words prima facie until we got to that hearing. During the interview by the commission investigator, she never uttered the words prima facie.
What would be the point of ordering to show cause? I mean, it's like, why would you have a hearing on an order to show cause if you'd already adjudicated someone in contempt?
She also used the words further contempt. So I don't know whether or not the hearing had to do with whether she was going to be held in further contempt and be sanctioned more than just the change of custody or not. But again,
Let me go at this another way. Let's take change in custody off the table. Was there any sanction ever imposed in this case?
No.
So if the change in custody was defensible as either a temporary custody order or one to rectify the mother's withholding of the father's visitation rights, where are we?
She was still found, whether there was a penalty or not, she was found in contempt. And that was improper, whether she actually was properly sanctioned down the road by incarceration or by a fine. She still had to go out and hire a lawyer to prove that she really wasn't in contempt. And again,
She had violated the visitation order. I think this record supports that.
I would suggest that there is evidence that she did violate some of the visitation orders. The visitation order that she was found to have been in contempt of was never reduced to writing, and she never got an opportunity to oppose that one. So I would disagree with you.
Right, on that one.
Right.
But I think there was a history of debates about...
There was a great deal of history, but there was never a notice and an opportunity to be heard on those issues.
Mr. Bradley, can I ask you this? We got a timeline here for various hearings and all of this were done, and our notes indicated that in May of 2016, there was a status check held in which Judge Hughes admonished the defendant here that she would be held in contempt if she does not comply with the visitation schedule. Then in June, a hearing's held and Judge Hughes did find her mom in contempt and so on and so forth. So it looks like there was some warning given to her. It wasn't an order to show cause. It wasn't done through the legal niceties and all that. It wasn't out of the blue here. Is that correct as far as what happened?
There was some notice. I would agree with that, Your Honor. However, there was no opportunity for a meaningful hearing so she could defend herself before she was found in contempt. And again, I agree with what the judges have said, that her orders are a mess and demonstrate that she doesn't know how to hold somebody in contempt, or maybe she's not sure how to do it. But aside from her orders that may lack some ambiguity, not only was her hearing testimony that she held her in contempt, it was her minute order saying she was held in contempt, and she testified that her minute order was a correct evidence of her intentions. There was also the interview where she admitted she held her in contempt, not prima facie, not planning to give her an opportunity for a hearing. And then there was interrogatory number three where she said, yes, I held her in contempt. So for the respondent to say she never held her in contempt is completely contrary to the record in this case.
Can I ask, I know that there was a judge that testified, Judge Hodgkins, for her behalf. Was there any testimony regarding who advised her from the family court to put the mother outside the courtroom and leave the child alone to speak to by herself? Was there any testimony that that's what the more senior judges told her to do?
The testimony wasn't that clear from the judges about precisely what their advice was. What is clear is none of the judges testified, the other judges testified, Judge Hughes to find her in contempt, not give her notice, not give her a hearing, and to use custody as a sword to punish her for an order that was never reduced to writing, and you're never going to get an opportunity to dispute my conclusion based on that. So I agree
on
that,
on that point, Mr. Bradley, and I'm sorry for interrupting, but I wanted to get this question out. If you have further information to offer to Justice Silver's question, please do so. But I think it's important to understand that the discipline commissioner's take on why the imposition of, I'll take their approach, imposition of temporary custody was indeed the sanction.
She said, in her,
we're looking at this record now,
right,
and
she
the actions
in,
of the commission.
She
and
said, in her orders, the reason I'm making this change is she violated the visitation order. Interestingly enough, if you go back and look at the tape where she's talking to the little girl, she says, the reason I'm making this change in custody is because you and your mom were not following my visitation orders. And then there was a gratuitous comment in one of the orders at the end, oh, and it's in the best interest of the child. But it was...
But visitation, equal visitation or honoring visitation is a best interest factor. In other words, our statutes are really clear that children should have both parents in their lives, if at all possible.
I would agree that is a factor. But she said, if you read the orders, listen to the Jaffs hearing, almost the overwhelming single reason she made the change of custody was one factor, and that is as a sanction for violating her visitation orders. I agree with what you just said, that it's important to have a parent that allows visitation and fosters a relationship with the other parent.
So I think there's three factors that are all kind of a nexus. There's like if one parent is messing with the child's relationship with the other, that's a factor that
sure.
supports.
I would agree with you.
So there's that kind of thing is our best interest factors, which
right.
makes it a harder case than Lewis and some of the others. In Lewis, the issue was dad wasn't paying child support, and so the judge says, okay, you can't see the kid. That's a pretty easy case for me. This one's harder.
No, I see there are two or three factors that do apply.
But Mr. Bradley, let's stay in our lane here. The question is whether or not there's clear and convincing evidence to support the decision of the commission. And your argument, as I understand it, is that that evidence and what you've been pointing to is present in the record.
Correct. And this court obviously is not, by its own standards, is not supposed to reweigh the evidence or reweigh the credibility of the judge. And the commission found that the judge's testimony that she did it as a prima facie finding of contempt was not credible based on the evidence. So I think that this court is left with that finding, that unless it's clearly erroneous, which I don't believe it is.
On the legal standards, to circle back a bit, Legal error, okay. The order should not have said, I find you in contempt and I'm issuing an order to show cause for a hearing why you should not be found in contempt. It's backwards. It's Queen of Hearts, sentence first, trial later. I get that that's incorrect. But is that a legal error that should be corrected on appellate review by the court with direct appellate jurisdiction? Does it rise to willful misconduct under Rule 8 particularly, which is a little different from the NRS 1 point, whatever it is? To me, I'm not sure there's clear and convincing evidence. I'm open to it, but I want to hear why there's clear and convincing evidence that she willfully violated the law in acting as she did. I'm not arguing no legal error
purposes
of that question.
Rule 8 requires an egregious legal error where there's an abuse of authority. I think holding somebody in contempt without a hearing, without notice, is an abuse of authority.
Even if you have the mistake that she thinks that to issue an OSC, she needed to have a finding of contempt to precede it. Like, let's say it's not prima facie. I don't understand it, but it happened.
The commission found that her testimony of a prima facie was not credible. So we're left with a record saying that she held her in contempt. And there's clear and convincing evidence that she held her in contempt. So you can set aside the judge's testimony that it was only a prima facie finding of contempt based on the standards of review.
But on clear and convincing, why would a person hold someone in contempt and then set a hearing to determine whether or not the person is in contempt? That is hard for me to say.
Again, she's failed to exercise her duties competently. There's no question about that. But the commission found that she did hold her in contempt, not prima facie. And it's not just the orders. If we only had the orders, that'd be one thing. But we've got the commission interview. We've got her own testimony. We've got her answer to the interrogatory that said, I held her in contempt. So I think there's clear and convincing evidence that shows she was held in contempt. Once you get there, then the commission was proper under Rule 8 to find an abuse of authority, an egregious legal error.
But let's take the words. What's troubling to me is the inconsistency between the saying, I find you in contempt and we're going to have a hearing on in order to show cause in the future why I shouldn't find you in contempt. To me, that suggests some problem with the word contempt and the way it's being used in sort of a mutable way.
I agree. If we only had the orders, there could be some more ambiguity, but
did the commission address that inconsistency? I didn't see it in the findings, but it may have been in oral argument or comments. Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yes, I am. I think that the commission found that her testimony wasn't credible based on a totality of the evidence, and the totality of the evidence included her hearing testimony where she admitted she held her in contempt. The totality included her court minutes saying that she held her in contempt. It was her interview where she said, I'm holding her in contempt. And it was her interrogatory that said, I'm holding her in contempt.
I understand, but what about the inconsistency and then scheduling a hearing in the future to find out whether you should be held in contempt? I mean, that's...
I believe that the commission took into account that those words were there, but that she had actually, they found that she did hold her in contempt.
Fair enough. I have a question.
But wasn't the subsequent further contempt.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't, we're going to do this over again later. It was further contempt, like the sword's coming down even harder.
Absolutely, and she used the word further contempt multiple times. In various orders, I believe, in both the minute order and the written order that she signed. So, again, the order show cause may have related to further contempt and incarcerate her or do something else to her. But she made it very clear on the record that she was making this, holding her in contempt and changing custody because of violation of the visitation orders, which is not permitted, impermissible under Nevada law.
Justice Silver.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I just was curious as the reasoning for
your requirement of a mentor in the future, especially where she had testified that she had gone in and talked to Judge Steele and Hodgkins and I believe Judge Elliott. Is there some other reasoning behind that, just out of curiosity? What was your point for that? Or would that be a senior justice as opposed to another family court mentor?
The reason I suggested a mentor is just that in looking at her track record as a family court judge, she's been reversed as of the writing of this brief 7 times. Over the weekend, I noted that she'd been reversed 2 more times. One was in direct violation of this court's decision in Fernandez that said you can't waive child support. So the mistakes that she's making are egregious. They're affecting the families in Clark County. And it's not as a sanction to her. It's not to discipline her further. It's just to protect the public. And I would ask that the court take judicial notice of this court's opinions and the Court of Appeals opinions reversing her. I'm not asking for a fine. I'm not asking for anything else based on that. But just that this court has the ultimate responsibility to decide what the appropriate discipline is. And again, I don't call it a disciplinary measure. It's a protection measure for the public.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I was a bit concerned about the citation of the appellate cases, not because that's not important information, but in any other setting, if someone cites things that are not part of the record before the underlying case, and here I went back and looked and I didn't see any of those were in there, that would be stricken. And Mr. Marks asked to have those references stricken because his client didn't get a chance to debate those, and then you don't have a right of response to that. He said that in reply. So I would like to understand your position on his request that those be stricken, because they weren't part of the commission proceedings and she didn't have notice that those issues were in play. She didn't get to say how many times she'd been affirmed or what the legal issues were and the legal error involved was. So I wanted to understand your position on that.
I attempted to be very careful to comply with this court's rules under citing Court of Appeals decisions, and I think in Forenz I said as a related case, and that's,
no,
how,
I understand
that's
that.
How I interpreted it. In hindsight, would have been better had I cross-examined her at the hearing about these reversals, absolutely, and I will learn from that.
That would be helpful. That
yes.
would be a fairer basis.
I would agree, and I do think that this court has discretion in determining what the appropriate discipline is to look at judicially noticed things, which would include her number of reversals, and I'd ask you to look to see how many times she's been affirmed at the same time. But I think under Mack versus Max's state that this court said it can be flexible in determining when to exercise judicial discipline. I'm sorry, judicial notice.
No, it was a mistake. You can't just reverse and
discipline. Okay. So, anything else you want to ask?
Just respectfully ask that this court affirm the commission's finding that there is clear and convincing evidence that Judge Hughes violated count one by holding her in contempt without a hearing, without notice, and with an improper, impermissive sanction. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Marks, that was lengthy. I'll give you 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. We all know the written orders control the minutes. And if you go to the record on appeal, starting at F605 and going through F619, there are 2 written orders. One of both of the June hearings. One's filed on the 14th and one's filed after that. If you go to App 609, and I think this answers Justice Pickering's question, at 609, which is page 5 of the 6-page order, it says, the court further finds plaintiff is in contempt of the court's order to facilitate visitation on weekends with father. cause appearing therefore, it is hereby ordered that based on the reasons stated above, an order to show cause shall issue. Now, obviously, the better practice, and I think we've seen a lot of Court of Appeals reversals of district courts more in the last, since we have a Court of Appeals, clearly should say prima facie. I think we've all become more used to that. But I don't think saying you're in contempt to a layperson and then setting the order to show cause, that's the proper procedure. So for counsel and the commission, who three of the six were lay people, kept saying she's held in contempt, held in contempt, held in contempt. She was not held in contempt. Justice Hardison, the reason she used further contempt, there had been a previous contempt over schooling where she was held in contempt. That's why she says further, not to pound on or not to pile on. And that issue was not before the commission. If the commission wanted to say there was a history here of other cases, they should have brought the other cases. It's totally unfair. They're complaining about the due process rights of the mom. They now, in their opposing brief, answering brief, add seven cases they never asked her about, never cross-examined. Normally, you can't, in this court, rely on things not on the record below. And they just flagrantly did that to violate her rights. So the written orders do also give, to answer Justice Hardison, she doesn't go through the 12 best interest factors. However, if someone has orders to see their child, and those orders, no one's saying they're not valid, that she didn't have due process, she had counsel, and you have an order to see your child, there is some debate among lawyers and judges, what more do you have to do to get that to happen? Often judges make errors in enforcement and get all before the commission by parents who are in violation of orders. There has to be a way the judge can enforce her own orders without having it second-guessed by the commission. And that's really what happened here. She didn't have to go through the 12 factors. If someone is supposed to get their child and doesn't, there can be an exchange. It could have been called makeup time. It could have been denoted clearer or better. But the underlying principle, both parents are supposed to be able to raise their child in a joint custody setting. That's an overriding state principle. To sanction a judge for enforcing that principle, when you look at clear and convincing evidence, she wasn't a rogue judge. She talked to Judge Elliott because Judge Elliott was a psychologist. How do you handle this? She talked to Judge Steele, and then she went to her presiding officer, Judge Hoskins. Both Judge Hoskins and Judge Steele testified at the hearing below. And they said this is what you'd have to do as a last resort or a writ of arrest. The commission called no judge. The commission relied solely on Judge Hughes, the interrogatories that you said you can't use in Tobiasen, which is another grounds for reversal. They relied heavily on inconsistencies between her testimony and interrogatories in Tobiasen, which came down after the briefing, I believe, or at the time of our answering brief, and they supplemented. You said you couldn't use Tobiasen. Counsel in argument used the interrogatories. In his opening below at the commission, he used the interrogatories. Their whole issue was credibility, that Judge Hughes wasn't credible, so we're going to sanction him.
But isn't it troubling to have a judge have said one thing in her orders and even as part of the investigation and then say something different when she comes in and testifies under oath in the hearing? Isn't that something that is some cause for concern?
It is cause for concern, but we're looking at she's charged with two serious crimes here, so to speak, violating someone's 14th Amendment rights, which she did not do, and using custody exchange as a punishment, comparing it to Lewis and Sims, which she clearly did not do, because the language in those two cases does speak of permanent and punishment. It's not where someone didn't know the law and custody has changed. Here she's trying to enforce eight prior orders going back to a predecessor judge of a case that she was kind of dumped on as a new judge. So look at the written orders, because we know the written orders do control the minutes. And in other words, if the written orders meet minimal standards or certainly don't violate the canons, she shouldn't be sanctioned if the minutes or her comments inartfully were incorrect or could have been cleaner. If the written orders are there in accordance with our law, which I suggest they are, there's not clear and convincing evidence to sanction her. And two other judges testified, this isn't great, but this is a problem in family court, and as a last resort, they have or could have agreed that it's something you do. And they had nothing to rebut that.
Ms. Marks, thank you. Was there another question?
I just had one more based on that, and there was kind of, that's all right. So you're saying that the other judges testified that the procedure to not have a hearing before holding somebody in contempt is proper?
No. Okay.
Nobody said that.
She wasn't held in contempt, but the issue of a pickup order...
No, I just followed up on what you just said, though, yes, about this is a problem and this is what they do in family court.
No,
so
no,
I have a question as to, in a follow-up, as to they said that this procedure and what she did here was proper?
On your
did they testify? Let's just say any part of it. They said this is proper, but she
did. As a last resort, to have a pickup order in court is something you can do as a last resort. If you go to App 609, I think if you read that, you will see she did not hold her in contempt. I know it sounds like she said she did. It sounds in the minutes, but in the written order. We know the written orders control minutes or oral statements of opinion. The written order does show she found contemptuous act or violations, as Justice Pickering put it, for more correct, obviously, and an order to show cause volition. And they went to an order to cause hearing, a contempt hearing later, and the mom prevailed. She was not found in contempt. So she's being sanctioned for something she didn't do.
Let me ask you this, just briefly. You disagree then that she never said that she held her in contempt when she was being investigated and answering interrogatories. So you disagree that she ever stated that she held her in contempt?
No, she did say that.
Okay, so
but she, because she was using it as prima facie or, as Justice Pickering put it, you violated my orders. She's looking at a litigant saying, I'm finding you in contempt for not facilitating visitation, not as a judge would officially hold someone in contempt.
So even when she's being investigated by the Judicial Discipline Commission for her procedure in this case, she still didn't understand the difference between contempt and a prima facie finding?
No, at that point she said prima facie, but counsel is saying you made inconsistent statements in answering interrogatories, you made inconsistent statements in the minutes. What I'm saying is she tried at a point in the process to save prima facie, and they use that to say you're lying, you're not credible.
What point in the process was that? That she changed and started using that term?
I don't remember the exact point.
When she was responding to interrogatories, she didn't use that term, did she?
I believe those are the interrogatories, by the way, under Tobias, and that are supposed to be thrown out.
That they can't be required to be under oath.
Oh,
that's the whole thing.
I cannot recall a page site, as to the exact site. But in the orders that were written, I think it's pretty clear when she used contempt, she meant it as prima facie, because the next line says, in order to show cause, hearing will issue. So why would you wouldn't be holding someone in contempt before the hearing? And I think she tried to explain that in the process, you know, the site of when she did. And they said, oh, you're lying. Their case is based on lack of credibility, not on a judicial evidence of a violation. They didn't call any judges. There was no evidence of it.
Okay, Mr. Marks, thank you so much.
Judge, I'd just like to correct. You made a comment about...
You should stand up, please, to the microphone so we can get this on our podcast.
I apologize. My colleague said that the interrogatories that were supposed to be thrown out were used. They were stipulated into evidence at page 461 of the record.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bradley. Mr. Marks, thank you for your excellent briefs and arguments. Mr. Gila as well. Ms. Young, thank you for everything. And we will take this case under submission. We'll be in